Okay. So how many of our guests are here for the first time? I know Swas already asked it. I just wanted to... If you're here for the first time? Okay. Just want to get an idea. All right, so I'm going to read a verse from the Bhagavad Gita and translation and Srila Prabhupada's purport and try to say a few things about it that hopefully will be of interest to both the newcomers and those of us who have been around for a while. I'm reading chapter 8, text 21. Avyakto shada iti uktas tamahu paramam gatim yam prapyananavartante tadama paramam mama. And the translation for that is, this is Krishna speaking, Lord Krishna speaking. He says, that which the Vedantists describe as unmanifest and infallible, that which is known as the supreme destination, that place from which, having attained it, one never returns, that is my supreme abode. And this is purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada, our spiritual master, the founder-acharya for the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. So Prabhupada says, the supreme abode of the personality of Godhead, Krishna, is described in the Brahma Samhita as Chintamani Dham, a place where all desires are fulfilled. The supreme abode of Lord Krishna, known as Goloka Vrindavan, is full of palaces made of touchstone. There are also trees called desire trees that supply any type of edible upon demand. And there are cows known as Sarabi cows, which supply a limitless supply of milk. In this abode, the Lord is served by hundreds of thousands of goddesses of fortune, Lakshmis, and he is called Govinda, the primal Lord, and the cause of all causes. The Lord is accustomed to blow his flute, Vainam Kvanantam. His transcendental form is the most attractive in all the worlds. His eyes are like lotus petals, and the color of his body is like the color of clouds. He is so attractive that his beauty excels that of thousands of cupids. He wears saffron cloth, a garland around his neck, and a peacock feather in his hair. Prabhupada says, in the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna gives only a small hint of his personal abode, Goloka Vrindavan, which is the supermost planet in the spiritual kingdom. A vivid description is given in the Brahma Samhita. So a little bit more about the spiritual world. And as we've heard, like, that's a description, very brief description. And along those same lines, I'd like to read a few sentences from a purport from the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 7, where Prabhupada says in one purport, in reference to this idea of going back to the spiritual world, Prabhupada says, it is said that here that when a living entity gives up this material embodiment and enters into the spiritual world, which we just heard a description of, you know, what's like there, how beautiful it is and everything. So when you enter into the spiritual world, you revive your spiritual body. And in that spiritual body, you can see the Supreme Personality of Godhead face to face. You can hear and speak to him face to face. And you can understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead as he is. It says from Smriti, also it is understood, Vasanti yatra purusha sarve vaikuntha murtaya. In the spiritual planets, everyone lives in bodies featured like this, like the Supreme Personality of Godhead's. As far as bodily construction is concerned, there is no difference between the part and parcel living entities and the expansions of Vishnumurti. In other words, at liberation, the living entity gets a spiritual body by the grace of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in other words, when devotees go back to Godhead, devotees, people who are practicing devotional service throughout their lives and are successful at executing the process favorably, the end of their life, they go back to Godhead. You get a spiritual body, and you get to associate with Krishna personally, just like it's what you heard described here. You see Krishna face to face. You're speaking with Krishna. You're interacting with Krishna. You have a personal relationship with Krishna. And as we heard in that first verse, you don't return. It's not like you go there and you can. Once you go back to Godhead, you're back. eternally. You're with Krishna in the spiritual world. That's the, as Krishna said, param gatim, that's the supreme goal, supreme destination. So it's something really to, something very wonderful, something to aspire for. It's a goal worth really striving for. And you know, devotees, many devotees here are on that path, already doing that. For a lot of people, though, it's kind of hard for them to believe that even that there is such a thing as a supreme personality of Godhead, a spiritual world. You know, they're far away from that. They're kind of stuck way back earlier in the picture. Like one thing that prevents a lot of people from having any faith in believing that there is a God or a spiritual world for that matter is that the problem of evil. It's a big stumbling block for a vast majority of the human population. Some people are very conscious of it. Other people, they just kind of, it's there, but it's, you know, just kind of like rumbling around in their head. They're not even conscious that that's what's kind of like holding them back. But basically the problem of evil, it goes something like this, that how could there be a God who is all-powerful, all-knowing, and benevolent, you know, all benevolent. Benevolent means like, you know, well-wishing like that. And all the horrible things that are going on in the world today, you know, the two, it doesn't seem like consistent. You know, if there was a God who was all-powerful and knew everything and was had control of everything, and if he was benevolent, then you couldn't possibly have, at least to their estimation, you couldn't have things like, you know, earthquakes, famines, disease. You know, I mean, the list goes on and on and on of different types of horrible things that are going on in the world, not just to human beings, but to animals and also to living creatures. So that's what prevents them from, you know, believing, being able to have that faith. And there is, you know, a God that's, at least of that description, that's all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-loving. Even you concede that, sometimes people who are atheists, they even concede that, okay, you know, the argument for design, it's been around for a long time, the argument for design goes something like this, that, you know, we could see that there's complex biological form, and it's no way that some of the characteristics of certain living entities, it doesn't seem possible that it could have evolved by some blind evolutionary process. There had to be an intelligence behind the whole thing. And then science is also pointing sometimes to how the universe is kind of, how do they put it, is designed for life. In other words, there's certain like constants that if they were just changed a little bit, then the universe would implode upon itself, or back in the early stages, all of it would have just dissipated as gas. In other words, you know, there's indications from even from scientific evidence that there's some sort of an intelligence operating, underlying what's going on here in the universe. But then the atheist, or at least the person who's having a tough time believing in a supreme being, their response to that would be, well, yeah, that may be evidence for some intelligence, but that's not evidence for a, you know, supreme being of the nature of what we're originally talking about. That's, you know, all powerful, all intelligent, and benevolent. And as you could have one, doesn't really necessarily mean that even if there is some intelligence behind the whole thing, it doesn't seem like he's benevolent. So how do we understand this? You know, how do we respond to those people? Well, to start, it's not like it's not an unreasonable thing for them to be thinking like that. It's understandable. Like, you know, given the kind of the base of knowledge that they're operating from, it's kind of understandable how somebody could think like that. Basically, their basic worldview goes something like this: that you're born, that's the beginning. You live. And you die, and that's the end. It's completely random. And it's just the very fact that you are alive, it's random. No, there's no cause behind it. There's no real ultimate cause behind it. It's just just luck of the draw that you happen to be born. The quality of life that you get, the fact that you're born as a human being as opposed to an animal, or a human being, a rich human being as opposed to a poor human being, it's all just random. And once again, just luck of the draw. Just even the fact that life exists or the universe exists is completely random. There's no, it just happens somehow. There's no, cause behind it, no explanation. So, given those kind of that set of premises, it's understandable how they can think that, well, how could there possibly be? And what you observe, and what they, thinking like that to start off with, and then observing what's going on in the world, it's understandable how somebody could think that, well, it couldn't possibly be a supreme being that knows everything and controls everything and what to speak of being benevolent. But so the thing is that you need more information. The Vedic way of looking at things is a little different. I'll try to describe that. In the Vedic picture of reality, picture of reality or worldview, it's something like this, that when you're born, that's not the beginning. That's the beginning of you in this body. See, and essentially, we're something beyond just this body. We're actually eternal spiritual beings, and we're in a body. And you live according in certain conditions. Those conditions that we're experiencing, that we're living in, have been awarded to us as a result of things we did in a previous embodiment. So, everything that, as a human being, everything that we do is being observed, evaluated, and responded to. And that response doesn't necessarily even come during this lifetime, this embodiment. It generally comes at the time of death in the form of you're awarded your next embodiment. See, so that's, the Vedic picture of reality, that we're souls, essentially spiritual beings. We're put in a body. We live out this lifetime. At the time of death, it's all taken in. Everything you've done as a human being is taken into account, the good, the bad, etc. And then you're awarded your next situation. It could be, most likely it's going to be, well, if you're not a pure devotee of Krishna, it's going to be another material body. And, one could say, the atheist would probably say, well, okay, that's nice, but is there any evidence for that? Is there any evidence that that's what's going on as opposed to what I think is going on, which is that you're born and you live and you die? Well, actually there is. It's not just because as far as they're concerned, you can't, if you try to tell somebody who's an atheist that, well, it says so in the Bhagavad Gita, that's the way it is, they'll just go, so what? That's just your dogma. That's just, why should I accept your dogma? It says in the Bible something different. It says in the Quran something different. It says, well, there is some evidence that supports that kind of picture I just presented. And that is, and it comes from a scientific community. It's children who remember their past lives. I'm not going to talk about it pretty much at all, but you can all investigate for yourself. You can just go on Google evidence for reincarnation, or even better yet, if you go to YouTube, and you could just type in Ian Stevenson. You can watch a video of a man who's like a mainstream scientist with impeccable credentials. Anyway, he did 40 years research into this phenomenon of kids who spontaneously remember when they, 2 years old, and they start talking about who they were in their past lifetime. And quite often, I think before he passed away, they did 2,500 cases. And of those, about half of them, they were actually able to match the personality. They're actually able to find the personality the kid claimed to have been. And, the statements the kids made matched, the life of that personality they claimed to have been. And all sorts of remarkable things, would happen, come out in the course of the investigation. The kids would be able to, lead the way to the house that they had formerly lived in. And it was like they take them in a train and they take them to a town that they claim they had lived in, 50, which is 50 miles or 100 miles or another country from where they were living now. And they just get out. These are 2-3-year-old kids, 4-year-old kids like that. And they lead the way to the place where they used to live. And when they got there, they could identify different family members. And they would try to trick these kids sometimes, saying, well, here's so-and-so, this is... And the kid would go, no, no, that's not so-and-so. That's my older brother from the past life. And they remember all sorts of things. And you know, quite often it was accurate. Anyway, so once again, I said I wasn't going to talk about I'm talking about it. Watch it for yourselves, you know. Just go on YouTube and watch the video or just check this out. It's an amazing phenomena. Even Prabhupada acknowledged it, really, because it's referred to in the Vedic literatures as Jati Smara. It means one who, you know, remembers his past life. It's mentioned in the Krishna book in that story with King Nriga, and also one place in the Bhagavatam, Maharaj Amsumam. It's a legitimate phenomenon. It's acknowledged in the Vedic literatures, and it's something that there's quite a bit of evidence for, you know, pretty decent quality evidence for, even, you know, to this day. So it supports this idea that we're souls in a body, and we're going from one body to the other, you see? And if it's true, it's significant. I mean, if you really, you know, check out this phenomenon and you think that this is really like an airtight case, it's significant because it's consistent with our worldview, and it totally contradicts the worldview that is being presented from modern reductionist mechanistic science. It contradicts the worldview that's of Christianity and Islam and all the other major world religions, except for one, Druze, which is not a major world religion, but they believe in also reincarnation. But so it's significant, you know, that it supports our worldview and it contradicts all these other worldviews. Anyway, going on from there, the rest of the picture is that, you know, we're souls, we're moving from one body to another. It's been going on for a long time, you know, according to, the Vedic literatures, the living entity has been in the material world for crores and crores of birth, which crores 10 million. It's been going on for a long time, but it hasn't been going on forever. Originally, we were with Krishna in the spiritual world. And due to misuse of our free will, we've had to come here to the material. It's like a punishment. Coming here to the material world is like punishment. But it's not because it's punishment, but it's punishment for a purpose. And that purpose is to educate, to re-educate us and train us again. Krishna is not sadistic. You know, he doesn't take pleasure in punishing for punishment's sake. You know, oh, you misused your free will, now you have to go to the material world and suffer, and I'm going to enjoy watching you suffer. It's not like that. Krishna's not happy about us being here in the material world. But in his infinite wisdom and mercy, he's understood that this is the arrangement that is best suited to rehabilitate us. And that's what this material world is. It's like a penitentiary. You know, if anybody familiar with that word, penitentiary. A penitentiary is a place where you go. It's punishment, but it's kind of like you learn something through that experiencing that punishment. Probably the expression that best describes it now here in this, you know, the common vernacular is tough love. You see, what we're experiencing here in the material world is tough love. It's love. It's actually love. Krishna loves all his parts and parcels, not just those who haven't misused their free will and are in the spiritual world with him, but he loves all the parts and parcels who are also misused their free will and have to come into the material world. And this is what we're experiencing here in the material world is tough love. It's love, even all the suffering, all the different kind of trials and tribulations that a person experiences, it's actually meant to help us understand that we cannot be happy. Our only happiness lies in living in total compliance with what makes Krishna happy. You see? And that's what we weren't prepared to do. That's why we had to leave, you know, be exited out of the spiritual world, so to speak, because we misused our free will. And that somebody could say, oh, wait a second, you know, why isn't that kind of cruel of Krishna to give us something which, if we misuse, is going to cause us so much suffering and so much unhappiness, be such a problem to us? Well, no, it's not. Because, and once again, Krishna in his infinite wisdom and compassion, he can understand it. We could handle it. It was fair. Just like, you know, somebody might argue, well, isn't it unfair to give people, for allow these people to be free citizens? Because somebody might use their free citizenship. They might become a criminal. And if they become a criminal, they might commit like a murder or a robbery or something like that and have to go to jail. And there are people in that condition. So therefore, we should take away the free citizenship from everybody. Because if we do that, then there'd be no question of somebody becoming a murderer or a robber and having to suffer in jail. But would you want that? No. You see, because along with the, you know, at least this is its analogy, it's kind of a crude analogy, as Prabhupada would say, but the idea is you can understand that along with the free citizen, the freedom, comes the ability to handle that freedom. You see? The governments wouldn't give people, you know, the United States government or any other democratic kind of government throughout the world, they wouldn't give people free citizenship if they weren't confident that these people have the ability to handle it. You know, they have potential, they're competent to handle it. And then some people, will, of course, will misuse it, and we'll deal with that. You see, but on the whole, we know people are capable of having, you know, being free citizens because they're also capable of, yeah. So that's Krishna's, you know, Krishna's thinking. I hope that's not too presumptuous. I mean, look, he gives us free will, but he knows we can handle it. And generally, most people are handling it. I saw a video of an interview Prabhupada had with some social worker from Australia. And, you know, the man came and visited Prabhupada, and they were talking about a lot of things. And at one point, the discussion came over to the thing about the spiritual world and the material world. So at one point, the man asked Prabhupada, what percentage of the living entities are in the material world? And Prabhupada said, 10%. And then he went, actually, then he sort of thought about it for a second. He said, actually, no, less than 10%. See, so the vast majority of jivas, or souls, are in the spiritual world with Krishna. They don't misuse their free will. They don't come here to the material world, you see. But just like the vast majority of people in the United States, there's 300 million people in the United States, they don't commit crimes, they don't wind up going to prison, you know. So Krishna gave us something that potentially could be a problem for us, but at the same time, you know, it wasn't a cruelty, it wasn't a mistake. He knew he could handle it, you know. I mean, we had the ability, capacity to handle it. And the proof of that is that over 90% of the living entities or the souls haven't messed up. They haven't come here to the material world. They're in the spiritual world and enjoying life with Krishna in some sort of a reciprocal loving relationship. But, you know, some of us have come here. So we have to be, you know, this whole material world is meant to kind of, as I said, re-educate us, you know. And just basically the lesson we need to learn is that our only happiness, as I mentioned before, is living in compliance with the happiness of Krishna. We have to be willing to be. What makes Krishna happy? I'm happy. We understand Krishna's happy by pure devotional service. You know, it's described in the Bhagavatam. There's, I think it's 9 processes of devotional service: Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu, Smaranam, Padasevanam, Archanam, Vandanam, Dasyam, Shakyam, Atmanivedanam. It's the same thing in the spiritual world. I never heard Prabhupada say that, you know, those are the 9 processes of devotional service for the material world, and in the spiritual world it's a whole different ballgame, it's a whole different kettle of fish. No, you know, it's those 9 processes are eternal, and when a devotee is willing to accept, you know, is prepared to favorably engage in those 9 processes of devotional service, then Krishna is pleased. That's what, in the spiritual world, that's what they're doing. They're engaging in those different, you know, processes of devotional service. Here in the material world, in order to, you know, relearn those, as I mentioned, the whole, you know, experience is meant to bring us to the point, you know, actually, as one purpa in the Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada says, unless one has a pessimistic outlook towards material life, one has no impetus to make advancement in spiritual life. You see? So how it's supposed to work is this, that, you know, you get the human form of life, and you know, you through your own experience, through seeing what's going on to other people and what you're experiencing yourself, you realize, wait a second, this is, I can't be happy. I'm not going to be happy trying to enjoy, you know, my senses here, but, you know, trying to make a lot of money and have a beautiful house, car, wife, family, you know, all these things. It's not going to work because, look, I'm already experiencing it's not kind of really working for me. And look at the thousands and millions of other people, the stories of all these. It's not working. It doesn't. It's got something else going on. So in other words, when you actually through knowledge that you're receiving from higher authorities and your own experience, the school of hard knocks, so to speak, you realize you can't be happy here in the material world, and you turn to, you look for spiritual life, then, and if you're very fortunate, and you come to Krishna consciousness, then you receive knowledge from the bona fide spiritual master, and he teaches you how to engage in devotional service. It's actually something we all already know. There's one nice verse from the Chaitanya Charitamrita. It goes, Nichasiddha Krishna Preme Sabhukabhinaya Shravanadi Sude Chitte Kodayudaya. The pure love for Krishna is lying dormant within the heart of every living entity, but it's awakened by the process of hearing chanting. So, you know, it's already there. We already know how to do it, but it's kind of covered over at the moment. But when we engage in the process again, when we take to devotional service again, it becomes like uncovered. It becomes reawakened. And it's just like Prabhupada, I think, gave the example of somebody who has amnesia. You know, somebody who has amnesia, it's not like they somewhere in them, and the knowledge is there of who their wife is, who their children are, and their friends and their family. And all, but it's just due to that disease of amnesia, they've kind of like temporarily forgotten. So that if they can be cured of the amnesia, then they remember everything again. It's not like they have to relearn everything necessarily. It's just, maybe part of the process of kind of getting them, curing them from this, they might have to, you know, jog their memory. That, you know, but basically at some point it just, they got it. It all comes back to them. So it's the same sort of thing with devotional service. We're going through this, you know, just mechanically performing devotional service, but at some point it's just, it all kicks in. Just like when you, maybe, I don't know if you've had the experience, if you had a car, the battery went dead and it's a manual transmission. And sometimes what you can do is, if the battery's not too far gone, you put it in second gear. You sit in the driver's seat. You put it in second gear. Actually, Papa gave this example. You put it in second gear. You're in the driver's seat, and you push in the clutch. You got it in second gear, and you get like three or four of your good buddies behind the car and push. And they just push it. And if they could push it at about 5 to 10 miles an hour, you know, when you get up like to a little, not that fast, but just a bit of speed, you know, then you lift your foot off the clutch and it's in second gear and it just kind of goes, and it all starts up again. It just turns over the engine turns over the, you know, moving like that just starts it up and, you know, gives about, it's called a jump start and it works. And it's the same thing with devotional service. We already know it all already. It's already there. And by, you know, engaging in devotional service again, sadhana bhakti, you know, by rules and regulations, it revives it. And that spontaneous devotional service, which is, you know, natural for the soul, will be reawakened. So that's the job of the spiritual master, to engage us in this sadhana bhakti. And another analogy that came, when we do it to his satisfaction, then he, you know, when he's pleased with our how we engage in devotional service, then basically your life's a success. Then, you know, that's your ticket back home, back to Godhead. It's just like one analogy that came to my mind, like somebody who's like, say, in an accident, working in a big factory or something like that, and they have some sort of an accident, and they fall from something or they get hit by something or whatever. Then before they can go back to work, they have to go see a physiotherapist. They have to, you know, go see an occupational therapist. And before the company will let them go back to work, that person has to sign them off. Okay, he's okay now. You know, he can move the way he has to move. He can think the way he has to think or whatever, you know. He's gone through. They've, you know, worked with that person. And they feel like he's real rehabilitated to the level where they'll sign him off and he can go back to work. And the company lets him go back to work. So it's the same thing, you know. It's like the spiritual master is the external manifestation of the suit. He's Krishna's representative. He has to sign us off. You know, when you engage in devotional service to the point, you know, so the spiritual master satisfies so that he's pleased, then he just goes, at some point he goes to Krishna, okay, this guy's ready, or this one, you know, this soul is ready to go back, and then you go back like that. You go back to the spiritual world, live with Krishna. So I don't know, how long am I talking for? This class usually goes to 6:15, is that right? With what time? 6:00, good, all right. So I have the uncanny ability to always talk longer than I thought I would. So I'll just stop there and ask if anybody has any questions or comments about anything I've said or anything I should have said or whatever. You know, please, yeah, such an annoying Prabhu. Will of Krishna, or the happiness of Krishna, yeah. So is there any other than being described, which kind of in this world Yeah. Thank you. Good question. Can everybody hear the question? Is there an incentive to be in compliance, or is it just something you've got to do, you know, even though you're in? Well, you know, it's kind of like the donkey and the stick. You know, the donkey's going along, and they're holding, you know, there's different ways to motivate the donkey. The donkey can be motivated by whacking him on the backside with a stick, and also the donkey, but that's the last resort. Actually, they also hold a carrot in front of the donkey, and eventually, you know, he sees the carrot, and he keeps walking forward thinking he's going to get the carrot. And sometimes, you know, they do give it to him eventually. After he does the work they want him to do, they eat him the carrot. So it's like that. So, you know, when we come to devotional service, we have to, yeah, that's, we have to learn to live in compliance to the will of Krishna. But Krishna is very merciful. Even in the very early stages of devotional service, Krishna allows the devotee to have what's called a higher taste. In the Bhagavad Gita, there's a nice verse, Vishayavanivartante Nahahara Shadehina. Rashavarjam asopiasya param drishta namartate, that the embodied living entity may be restricted from sense enjoyment, but the taste remains. You see, that's the problem. Like, you know, you hear, or you can't, all these rules and regulations, no illicit sex, no meeting, no intoxication, no gambling. And, you know, an ordinary person off the street, they'd be going, well, actually, what do you do for fun? I mean, actually, there's one anecdote like that where one of Prabhupada's godbrothers went to England, London, and some British, I don't know, nobleman or something. Yeah, he had some sort of like he's a lord or something like that. And he asked, can you make me a Brahmin? And to Prabhupada's godbrother. And Prabhupada's godbrother said, yes, certainly. He says, so what is involved? He said, well, you just have to give up illicit sex, meat eating, intoxication, and gambling. And then, okay. And the man said, impossible. It doesn't involve. So, you know, we hear about all these different rules and regulations, restrictions. Kind of, it seems like sometimes kind of very formidable, but Krishna's very merciful. Even as I said, even to some, you know, to beginners, people just taking the devotional service, he allows you to have a higher taste. It means you'll be chanting and you'll be able to relish the transcendental sound vibration. You'll experience pleasure from chanting. You'll experience pleasure associating with the devotees. You'll experience what you can understand. You know, you'll direct perception of the self by realization. You'll understand yourself. This is not a material pleasure. When you're chanting and you're experiencing that higher taste, you'll know. You don't have to ask anybody. You're experiencing a spiritual pleasure. When you're reading the books and you're getting like all sorts of realizations, once again, you know. So that's the incentive that Krishna gives us, a taste. It's kind of like, pardon the analogy, but like when somebody joins the military, they have what's called a sign-on bonus. You know, the person, he's joining, but just to kind of like make it, you know, so they don't have any regrets about the whole thing, as soon as they sign the contract, they give him $5,000 or $10,000. It's a sign-on bonus. So, you know, Krishna does like that. It's like a bit of a, sometimes he gives devotees a sign-on bonus. When somebody makes that decision, okay, I'm committed. I'm going to do this. I understand this philosophy. I've heard it. I understand it with my intelligence. And now I'm going to try to do this. And Krishna goes, you know, he's in your heart. He understands everything. And he goes, good for you. Here, have a little bliss. It's a sign-on bonus. Doesn't necessarily stay. So, you know, if you experience that and it goes away, don't be freaked out because there's a sign-on bonus. It's not, you know, once again, it's not like the military keeps giving that guy $10,000 every week or year or something like that. It's a one-time thing. But Krishna does do that. And, you know, but also, I mean, you can have a good experience. If devotees are very sincere and if you're very careful from the very beginning about your devotional service, you can, you know, get a taste and keep that taste for, you know, throughout your career as you're progressing in devotional service. So that's the incentive. There is pleasure. There's pleasure in devotional service, in the chanting and, you know, engaging in devotional service. And when all else fails, there's always prasadam. So, you know, you can't lose. No, thank you. Good question. Did I answer it? So, any other questions or comments? Okay. Well, let me ask my godbrother a question here. Is Krishna the same color in Vaikuntha as he is in Goloka Vrindavan? Not. Is he? Is Krishna? No. You don't know? You know? Is Krishna the same color in Vaikuntha as he is in Goloka Vrindavan? Or is it, you know, like are all the Vishnu expansions of Krishna exactly the same color as Krishna? Shyamasundar. Like sort of blue-black, but with a kind of a blue view. Well, I don't know. I don't know why this white Krishna's then. Yeah. Somebody help me. Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, that's true. Right. Yeah. Does that answer your question? Doesn't? Okay. Thank you. Yeah, Chaitanya was golden. So, you know, it's all Krishna. Mata? Yeah. Yeah, sometimes devotees get that confused because, you know, when it's, sometimes it talks about how the material world is like the one, Ekapad Vibhuti, and there's Tripad Vibhuti that refers to the spiritual world and Ekapad, but that's referring to like the geographical size. It's like something Bhaktivinoda Thakur presented to give people a bit of a handle on, you know, to compare the material universes to the spirit. But that's referring to the size. But as far as like demographics go, Prabhupada, at least on this occasion, indicated to this man, he said 10%, and then he thought about it for a second and he corrected himself. No, it said less than 10%. Yeah. Well, you know, there are pure devotees and there are pure devotees. I don't think you have to be a pure devotee like Srila Prabhupada. You have to be a pure devotee. But like Srila Prabhupada is a pure devotee and he's like, you know, of a special magnitude. He's, you know, there's even among, you know, even in the spiritual world, it's not like all the devotees are on the same level of devotion necessarily. They're all pure devotees, but like, for instance, Radharani is the greatest devotee. It's not like all the devotees are on the level of Radharani. So, I mean, I don't think go back to the spiritual world, you do have to be a pure devotee. We've heard Prabhupada say that, but you don't have to be on the level of Srila Prabhupada. I don't think you know. Yeah, such an airport. Yeah, right. You know that there's the one famous pastime, Dina Bandhu tells it on the Prabhupada Remembrances, where Prabhupada gave a class here and towards the end of the class he said, you know, Krishna, even if you're 80%, I said, if you're 90% Krishna conscious, you can go back. And the devotees were kind of like a little bit disappointed because they thought, wow, man, that's kind of hard, you know. And he said, well, then Prabhupada saw, and he saw the response. The devotees said, well, 80%. And they were still kind of like, and then Prabhupada said, as the class was ending, he said, well, actually, 70%, you can go. And then he, according to Dina Bandhu, then he stood up, and the class was finished, and he had his cheddar, he threw his cheddar over his shoulder, and he said, he looked back, and he said, well, 60%, but not less. Something like that. So, you know, by the mercy of the spiritual master, we shouldn't take advantage of that and think that, oh, you know, we'll take it easy, but we should try our best, and, you know, Prabhupada will make up the slack, sort of thing. Yeah. Oh, Hari Bapu, Jai. Jai, don't you? That's a good question, and I think I could, because I've had that one I've thought of that question myself before and also had it asked to me, so I'm kind of got a bit of an answer prepared, and I hope it's be good. Actually, you can come back again. I heard Prabhupada ask that very question on a morning walk conversation. He was walking with devotees. And despite the fact that in this verse I read, it says here, having attained it, one never returns. That is my abode. But a devotee asked Prabhupada about that, and Prabhupada said, well, actually, you have the free will, so you can come back again, but it's very unlikely. And he gave the example, just like when a child that learns that fire will burn. So he might stick his hand in the fire once, but it's very unlikely that that same child is going to stick his hand in the fire a second time because he learns his lesson. See? So that's the way Prabhupada responded to that devotee, that it's possible that you'll come back again. You could go back. You can go back to the spiritual world, and you can misuse your free will again. But it's very unlikely, just like it's very unlikely that that child's going to stick his hand in the fire a second time and get burnt. So that's the best way I could answer that. It is possible. I clearly heard Prabhupada say that it was possible to that, in response to that devotee's question, but that was the example he gave. Hopefully. Yeah. Yeah, you're eternally related to your spiritual master. So maybe I should stop there. I don't want to, but if anybody else has any more questions or anything like that, I can sit here for a few minutes. You can come up and ask individually. What? Oh, sorry. Well, okay. Sure. Ordinary people, or just say yogis? Well, yeah, no, there actually is something like that. If you study this kind of phenomena, there's people who predict that, they say, I want to take birth in this, your family as your child, and then there's kind of seems to be evidence that's what actually happens. So it's not like if you studied, the cases that this man has, worked on for those 40 years, there are examples of that, of people predicting the family that they're going to take rebirth in. Among the Tlingit, the Eskimos in northwestern America, it's kind of most prevalent there in that culture for some, can't remember the reason why he suggested, but it does happen. It is something that happens. Why did you ask that question? I mean, in general, no, but, in those some few very rare situations, it has happened. It's not like it's unheard of or this is some precedent for it. Can I talk louder? Maybe I'm a little hard of hearing. Maybe as Foss was saying, I'm all that loud music I'm getting. The Bhrigu Samhita, yeah. I don't know. And Prabhupada does mention it in the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam. He mentions that, and he says you can learn about your past, present, and future from that. I think it's called the Bhrigu Samhita. Yeah. So Prabhupada mentions it in the purport in the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam, and as it is something to be taken seriously. So yeah, I guess. One last question. That's it. Yeah. New person. Correct. That is devotional service. That's devotional service. If you're remembering Krishna throughout your life, you'll be able to remember him at the time of death. That can only be possible by if you're favorably engaging in devotional service. That's not something other than devotional service. That's a very important part of devotional service. As a matter of fact, I think it's in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, different Vedic literatures stated that of all the rules and regulations, that's the most important. Smartavyam satatam vishnura, na smartavyam na jatu sit, sarve vede na sita sura, etayo evakinkara. That always remember Vishnu and never forget him. That's of all the rules and regulations, that's the sum and substance. All the other rules and regulations are meant to be servants and assistants. to that one main most important principle of always remember Krishna and never forget him. So if somehow or another you can remember Krishna at the time of death, even if you weren't practicing devotional service throughout your entire life, you go back to Godhead. I'll just tell one teeny little story on that point. There was one devotee, his name was Kartikeya, and his mother was not favorable. You know, she was not favorable at all. But he was, he kept in touch with her, he kept that relationship going. And then she became ill, and he went to visit her in the hospital, and he came, and they said, "Oh, your son is here." And she was just like ready to, she was on her way out. She was like on the verge of leaving her body. So she, got her wits together, and she said, "So, is your Krishna here now?" And she left her body. Devotee Kartikeya went back and told Prabhupada that. And Prabhupada was really happy. And he says, "Just see, due to her son, she's gone back to Godhead." So, that story is there. If it's an accurate story, it's a very special thing. If you somehow or another, if somebody remembers Krishna at the time of death, they go back to Godhead. It's like a special blessing. But generally, it's just like if you want a degree, generally you have to go to school and do all the courses and write all the papers and take all the exams, and then you'll get a degree. But sometimes the universities award an honorary degree, but you can't bank on it. It's not a good idea to sit home and think, "Well, I'll just, I won't go study, I won't do anything, I won't lift a finger, but I'll get an honorary degree." Most likely it won't happen. But does, sometimes somebody, one of our devotees here, Drew DeKarma, got an honorary PhD from a university in Europe for his work in evolution like that. Generally it doesn't happen. So it's the same thing. Generally you have to practice throughout your entire life to remember Krishna, being faithfully engaged in devotional service, and then you'll be able to remember Krishna at time of death. But due to some fluke or something like that, you're able to remember Krishna. Anybody's able to remember Krishna at time of death, they go back to Godhead. That's the causeless, inconceivable mercy of Krishna. Anyway, I better stop there. If anybody has any further questions, I'll be here. You can come up, just come forward. Otherwise, thank you very much. Grantaraj Srimad, Grantaraj Bhagavad Gita Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Thank you.
Who can deny that? You are always. Thank you.
Are you still in the